Hello and welcome to Virtual Philanthropy's Virtual Tour. I'm your host, EJ Jacobs. The Virtual Tour is an effort to demystify the philanthropic process for nonprofits and is led by someone with a prominent role in philanthropy. Today's person in philanthropy is Rona Pelligal with the Fund for Global Human Rights. Thank you for joining me today, Rona. It's the first time I've actually had to say your surname out loud after all these years of knowing you, so I hope I got it correctly.
Thank you. You did get it correctly. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get started, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I've worked in the human rights field for about 24 years. I have an academic background as well as a journalistic one. And I have been at the Fund for Global Human Rights for the past 6 years as the Vice President for Development and Communications.
Now, the Fund for Global Human Rights occupies a space with many other funds. You have the Fund for the Global Fund for Women. You have the Global Fund for Children. You have just the Global Fund, which is actually dedicated specifically to HIV. How do you stand out in such a crowded field?
I think we try to stick out in terms of the way in which we work more than anything else. I think you're right to point out that the naming can be confusing sometimes for people. But I think people who know the fund know it well. And it was when I joined the organization, I felt that it was a very well-kept secret from a small group of donors. And I've worked to try to change that in the time that I've been at the fund.
Given that you're a human rights organization, a global human rights organization at that, and last I checked, there's no shortage of issues happening around the world, is there an area that pulls at you more than others?
Sure. My background is as an Africanist, so I usually think of that first. I have been thinking about, for example, the crackdown on LGBT people right now in Uganda and the law that was recently passed criminalizing same-sex sexual behavior. And I have worked with those groups and know some of those folks. And so that is something that I'm both watching and careful about and concerned about. I also think quite a lot, sticking to Africa, about the labor rights abuses that we've seen, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the abuses that take place at the community level wrought by armed groups and companies that are involved in resource extraction, and in particular, the impact on women. And then going across the continent, staying with the African theme, I've previously worked in Sierra Leone and in Liberia, and I'm really impressed by the fund's work there to engage youth and to enable youth to participate in decisions about where resources go to their communities.
You mentioned two things there that jumped out at me. First, the LGBTQ plus work that's happening, that needs to be happening in places like Uganda. In the past, you were able sort of to name and shame and work with donors and work with governments to sort of get these things away. But it seems like we've long passed the idea of naming and shaming. So how do you actually affect change in places like that where you may not have the same kind of leverage or tools that you had in the past?
It's a really good question, and it's a really good point. And at this point, in naming and shaming alone or primarily probably won't affect social change. One of the reasons I joined the fund was because I loved its methodology of supporting grassroots human rights groups who could engage their communities to press for change, starting at the local level and going all the way up to the national level, if not beyond. And we have seen great success in being able to support actors and groups and movements to effect that kind of change. And they do so even in cases where they are facing the kind of repression that we are seeing in Uganda. And if we can't affect the change there now, we invest for the long term. We know that we are planting seeds for the future. And in case of an emergency, for example, we are able to evacuate people or support them in other ways they might need beyond grant making.
And the other thing you mentioned there was just the work you're doing in places like DRC and the places that are near and dear to your heart. I'm just thinking about the fact that when we talk about human rights, we seem to have suddenly forgotten about Africa. We sort of felt like maybe things have been paused while things are happening in other parts of the world. most currently in Kosovo, as well as in Ukraine, obviously. How do you keep that on people's radar?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's especially interesting when you think about the kind of attention that a place like Ukraine deservedly gets, but yet other places like Syria or Ethiopia or Sudan kind of fall off the map. And I think there's something there to be interrogated. The question of keeping it on the radar is an interesting one for us because, on one hand, we're supporting activists who do this work at their own peril, and at the same time, we want to elevate their work. And so there's a creative tension in our work in terms of wanting to elevate what the grantees and partners that we have are doing, and at the same time, not wanting to jeopardize their well-being.
Now, your organization is a re-granting organization, so you're giving grants, but you're also receiving grants. How do you feel the conversation goes between both parties in terms of how you operate and how you facilitate those conversations? You're not obviously just giving money to a nonprofit. You're also the voice of that nonprofit for donors, but you're also not just granting money to nonprofits. You're also representing what donors want to see with those funds. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting place to be. We try to model good behavior for as a donor to the nonprofits and organizations and individuals that we support. We make multi-year grants. We invest for the long term. We give general support. And we wish that our donors did the same for us, and not all of them do. So we also then bear some of the, I guess, risk in some ways for our grantees to the donors who support us. And we are able to translate whatever restricted or targeted funding we get into general support for the grantees.
In that modeling that you're doing there, how do you model success then? Because obviously you have a version of success you'd like to see for your, I would say, allies. We spoke earlier and try not to use the term grantees as much, but for the implementing partners, you have a vision of success. Obviously, how do you monitor that to make sure that you also model that for your donors as well?
Yeah, we do some donor advocacy. We try to engage in productive and collegial conversations with our own donors about, for example, the institutional support that we need to be able to do our work well. And I think there's probably even more of that we could do. We have communications. When I joined the fund, and I mentioned it was a sort of well-kept secret, we had no communications team. We have a communications team now. And part of what we do is try to disseminate ideas about what good philanthropy looks like, especially in promoting social justice.
I think of organizations like a Crisis Action where they basically have to operate completely in secrecy. So nonprofits, or rather donors who work with them, donors who are supporting the work that they do, understand that they can't see tangible work on a regular basis. They have to sort of hope that the work that they're doing is going to create a success. And that might take 4 or 5 years down the road. So it does exist. There are examples where organizations can't, you know, put on a dog and pony show for the donors, but the work is still happening and it may take 4 or 5 years. I think when we talk about this incremental type of work, how much patience do you find that the donors have as opposed to how much patience you have with your own grantees or allies, as you say?
Well, I think it depends who the donors are. 3/4 of our funding comes from private foundations, and many of those foundations have offices or program officers who live in the countries where we work and can observe firsthand the kind of support that we provide people who are engaged in improving their communities. And so I think they can see the incremental progress there, as well as the setbacks. Among other donors, perhaps, who are not as well, who are not exposed as much to ideas of trust-based philanthropy and who privilege impact in a narrow way, it can be a harder, lesson to learn. But again, we try very much to engage in conversations and educate our donors to the best of our ability.
You've mentioned trust-based philanthropy there, and I just wanted to touch upon that a little bit more. Obviously, it's virtually impossible to operate in the human rights sector without trust. Like I said before, you don't know what's going to happen year after year. You don't know that there's going to be a bombing here or an attack there or a ceasefire. You can't predict these things. So how do you gain the trust of donors who are the ones you said that don't always understand? How do you keep that trust, or how do you sort of re-energize that trust between them?
Yeah, I think being honest helps, and I would say that anyway. and I do think that a lot of this work, whether as the donor or as the grantee, depends a lot on establishing relationships of trust. And I can remember a few scenarios where I had to call a donor and say, "Look, this didn't turn out the way we expected, and here's what we're doing about it." Or here's something we've learned, and here's how we're adjusting. And we pride ourselves on having that kind of relationship with our own grantees who come to us not only telling us what's going well, but what's not going well, because we see it as our job to be of support and service to them. And our best donors, I would say, feel that way about us.
Well, without any further ado, I'm going to lead you towards the shameless plug. This might be a bit difficult because you're working with so many nonprofits around the world, and maybe you want to sort of give a number to people about how many you're actually working with globally. So I won't necessarily ask you to share one organization unless you really want to, but maybe some initiatives that you're working at or some areas that you're working in that really need highlighting.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I mean, we give more than 350 grants per year. We work in more than 25 countries. We recently started a new initiative called the Legal Empowerment Fund. Two large donors came to us and said that they wanted to invest funding to support legal empowerment throughout the world, which means they wanted to be able to enable people to know, shape, and use the law. And there are many people throughout the world, as you know, who don't have access to the law,
absolutely,
who can't file complaints if a crime has happened, or who can't see justice done if they've been persecuted in some way. And we have been able to disperse hundreds and hundreds of grants in the past few years through that initiative. And I think it's a really interesting initiative for a few reasons. One is that we're doing it in partnership with these donors and also with other nonprofits. We're building on work that some have already created. And so there's a lot of synergy there. And the project itself has its own steering committee and grants advisory committee. So if there's a way in which it's part of the fund and there's a way in which it's autonomous. But we see this as a really interesting extension of what we do. I would also point out that we're really interested in climate justice and moving more into that space. We have seen firsthand the impact of poor decisions around natural resource rights, for example, and the ways in which they affect our grantees. And we can see even the impact that climate change has on people around the world, leading them, for example, to migrate. And so I think we're going to see many more climate migrants and refugees. And finally, I would point out the fund's work, I'm lumping a few things together here, on LGBT rights, on women's rights, and on youth rights. I particularly am interested in and believe greatly in the importance of youth rights, because youth are going to be our future leaders, and there's a lot of energy around youth and what they can provide and generate.
Now, I'm thinking about, for every donor that comes with these amazing ideas like the Legal Empowerment Fund, there might be a donor who says, "Hey, let's go and bring a bunch of umbrellas to people who are suffering from a flood." How do you deter the donors who come in with great ideas versus the donors who come in with ideas that may not necessarily be as great as they might think they are? How do you shape those ideas into something that could be workable, or tell them, no, that's not actually going to work? Is that an easy conversation to have?
It's not bad. We're pretty clear on our values, and we have internal processes for making decisions about what opportunities we'll take on and which ones we won't. And so if somebody comes to us and says, "We want to using your example, provide umbrellas in the case of a flood, we might say, well, we don't do that. We can tell you who does. Here's what we do, and we're really interested in, well, why is there all this flooding? And why is the climate seeming so erratic these days? And what are the things we can do with communities to ensure that they're better able to withstand these kinds of changes?
And with that, I'll let you start the tour.
Sure. We have what might be a unique way of working. All of our program officers and directors live in the countries where they make grants. Most of them are from those countries and from even the movements that they are now supporting. So their proximity means that they are well-versed in the issues and in the players. And also, it also means that if things are not going well, for example, they will inevitably hear about it. So it's very often that the program officer or director will approach the potential partner more than the partner will approach us. And the program officer or director for the fund will likely know of this group and be following it and seeing that it's doing something really interesting around the arts, for example. We're trying to invest much more now in the arts and in narratives to ensure that that rights have a broader base of support. They might be able to observe the group getting good publicity, like being featured somewhere or getting traction on something that might have been unthinkable. There is a group that we support in Tunisia, if I'm not mistaken, and it's an LGBT group that now runs a film festival. And that was an incredibly innovative thing to do. And our program officer / director saw that and thought, wow, that's incredible. That's going to really change the way, ideally, that's going to change the way in which people understand and think about LGBTQ plus people in North Africa, for example.
I think that's also a great example because it's not a conventional way of talking about human rights. I think when people say, let's support human rights, it almost always sounds like it's a legal battle somewhere, or it's a legislative battle, or it's a battle of changing minds at the top level, at the government level. But this is something quite different. It's about talking to people on the ground and changing their minds at the ground.
Exactly. And we have always thought about rights as being expansive. Our rights work is partly about legal advocacy and legal education. It's also about service delivery sometimes, or education, or connecting people, or monitoring. So it really depends on what the issue is and what the resources are and strengths are, I suppose, of the organization. And what's most needed. We think of rights not in a narrow legal way, but in a much more expansive way.
Clearly, and with success. I'd love to attend that film festival if I ever get to Tunisia. And how long is the process?
That part I'm less familiar with. I mean, we do our own vetting. And but we try not to make it onerous for the grantees. This is in part our trying to be a model grant maker. The grantees do have to fill out a short proposal and answer a few questions about how they plan to use the funds. Then we do our due diligence as well before providing any of the funding. But we try to make this process as painless as possible for the grantees. And I would say that that's true for the fund writ large, that we try not to burden the grantees beyond the burdens they already face being activists in countries where they are fighting for rights that are routinely denied.
What is something that nonprofits should know once they actually are an ally, a grantee partner?
I think they should know that they can be honest with us, that we stand with them in solidarity, that we can provide financial support, but we can also provide moral support and provide other resources, technical advice and the like that they might need as part of being an activist. And I think that is the best way to think about the fund.
I'm going to move you to the mistaken identity part. I'm thinking the fact that you work in so many countries. What happens when somebody comes to you who their work is very aligned with work that you're doing, but maybe not in the right country. Maybe they're working in Benin instead of Sierra Leone or something like this. Or the work is very closely aligned to something else that you care about, but not necessarily something you're supporting. How do you have that conversation with those grantees or those potential grantees?
Sure. I would say that we say, look, the work you're doing is really interesting. It's not quite what we're funding right now. It doesn't fit within our current portfolio. We're happy to keep it in mind. Here are some other donors you might want to look at. And, you know, here, you know, maybe here are some things you might do to strengthen what you're doing or plug into other things that are related. So being as helpful and constructive as possible.
I've asked this question of a number of people on the podcast. Do you think it's incumbent of donors to be able to give names of other donors or potential donors to nonprofits when there's not really an alignment within their organization?
I don't know if I would use the word incumbent, but I would certainly recommend it. And I probably would not do that without checking with the donor first. I myself get pulled into this all the time, actually, because I know a lot of donors, and people come to me and say, I'm looking for this. Will the fund support me? And I say, well, probably not. And I say, but I have a couple of ideas. Let me check with my contacts and see if they would be willing to speak with you. And I'm very happy to do that. And I think that is really important. And I wish more donors did it, to be advocates for if not their own grantees, then others who come to them where there is some, you know, synergy or some, you know, some reason that the group does deserve support.
I can agree, obviously, as somebody who gets asked multiple times if I might know a donor. I mean, we've had that conversation quite recently as well. And that there's a difference between saying, yes, like, I know this person, and yes, they will give you money. And I think there's, when you're working with, obviously, higher level nonprofits, they understand that. But sometimes, especially a more desperate organization, will pin hopes on something where it's really just a conversation. And it's hard to sort of tell them, I'm just going to send an email. That's all I can possibly do. And I don't know what that's going to do. But it's hard when you see somebody, especially a worthy organization, but not an aligned organization.
Yes. And sometimes these processes do take a long time. I mean, I would say that even in the best of circumstances, going from an introduction to a donor to securing a grant could easily take 18 months. And I would encourage grant applicants to think about building a relationship and thinking about this not in terms of when can I get money, and the boards, of course, need to understand this as well, but we're going to try to build a relationship with these folks, get to know one another, and find if there's areas that in which we have mutual and common interests.
Thinking of the do's and don'ts, what is at least one do and one don't that you would offer to a nonprofit?
The first thing that comes to mind is don't nag. Because I don't think that works very well. At least it doesn't for me. And what to do is share what you're doing, collaborate with others, be helpful.
I always find it interesting that so many people start with the don't. It's always the thing that sticks on their mind. Oh, just don't do that anymore.
I guess that one's easier to think about, I guess.
What are some experiences, or at least one, that you have in terms of engaging with a nonprofit or even engaging with a donor, given the unique experience you have of being on both sides?
Well, one experience that I'm proud of is that we have a donor at the fund who started giving to us at a pretty low level. The person traveled with the fund, then got interested in some of the work we were doing, and gradually increased his gift to be a six-figure gift over, you know, per year for several years. And I'm proud of that because there was a lot of work that went into creating that relationship of trust and working with that donor to come to a mutual understanding of what he could support and what would be most advantageous for us. I'm not quite sure if that was what your question intended, but
nope.
That's what came to mind.
My question My question had no bounds, so whatever answer you wanted to provide is perfect. I think that's actually a great example, especially for startup organizations that feel like, oh no, this donor wants to come in, but it's such a low rate. How do we convince them to give more? And it really is about patience. It really is about having the time to say, let them get to know who we are before we go in and ask for more. Because they also want to know who we are, but we want to know who they are. Maybe they don't have the ability to give more than what they're giving. Maybe they do. But let's make this a relationship that's more than just about the initial gift.
I totally agree with you.
So now it comes to the part where the questions come from someone other than myself, people who are more familiar with the work of the Fund for Global Human Rights. And the first question is, how do you prioritize which human rights to focus on, especially in an ever-changing landscape?
We see human rights as multifaceted and, to use a jargony word now, intersectional. We focus our work thematically and geographically, and I would say the geographic is the root, but we then layer on the themes. And so, for example, if there is, let's say, a worker in India who is denied basic labor rights, we will approach that question, you know, as a possibly a workers' rights situation, but then we'll think about, well, what is the caste of that person? What's the religion of that person or that group? Where are they based? What is their relationship with the government or the police? And so I guess what I'm saying is that we don't think about rights in terms of just a specific identity only, but mostly in terms of the multiple identities that people have. And then in terms of the importance of issues, I think that depends a little bit on each location. So using India as an example, labor rights are important there in one facet of our work. And there are other places where that might not rise to the top given some other pressing concerns. So it really depends on what we regard as the most important issue or issues in a country, the issues on which groups are working, the places where there's the greatest potential to shift the landscape or to affect some kind of change. So there really is a multiplicity of issues that come up.
Now, you started with the word intersectionality, so you brought the jargon in. So I'm going to let that continue with the second question here. What would you say to nonprofits about incorporating intersectionality, preparedness, in their work that captures multiple issues affecting the community without stretching capacity beyond its limits?
So one of the things that we look at the fund is we look at not just the work that organizations are doing, but how they're doing the work. And by that, I mean also how are they internally structured? What is their leadership like? Do they practice feminist leadership? Do they have second line leadership in place? Are, you know, like using women as an example, are women included in decision making, or do they occupy positions of power? And so that is something that we will look at when we are making grants, and we have a holistic approach to the work of our allies.
I will leave you with a question about the future. What is something you would like philanthropy as a whole to eradicate or cure in your lifetime?
I would say wealth disparities, but I have to say that I also don't think philanthropy can do that because philanthropy is a product of wealth disparities.
And I was thinking that, but no.
Yeah, I'm not sure that philanthropy is the place to do that. I mean, I wish it would and could, but I'm afraid that that's an issue that would require concerted government action and corporate action. And I see philanthropy as filling in those gaps and ameliorating the inequalities that we have and hopefully not reproducing them. So that would be my goal for the future.
Rona Pelagal with the Fund for Global Human Rights. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, CJ. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Have a great day and thank you for listening.